welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, hey, another great show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality, certainly science, and in addition, some understandings, we'll say, that go beyond what I've said before and what maybe some other people have presented on a similar subject. I'm talking tonight about God's plan for the development of consciousness in life. Now, this is a presumptuous title because it's stating that the plan for the development comes from a being we call God, and that development is for the purpose of life becoming conscious. And all of that put together is one big, giant concept. So I'm going to kind of break it apart a little bit, and I'm going to define what I'm talking about as I usually try to do during the first 40 minutes or so of the show. In addition, I want to mention, even before we get going, I may sound, and I hope I do, as good as I have been for some time, because, or better than I have been for some time, because we have some new equipment. Finally got the equipment installed and working. Sometimes you can buy things, but they don't necessarily work. So we've got that going, too. And thanks to the people who have helped out with this, Gene in Texas, and Ian and Amber in Australia, and a few others who have contributed in ways that have made it possible for us to procure this stuff, and allows the show to really sound the way I did when I was on broadcast radio, which has been a while. It's been, you know, I was on broadcast radio for like, what, 5 years or something. But during that time, I took for granted the technology, because there I was using the studio of a more professional studio than the one that I'm talking out of, even right now. But sure enough, it was because of the equipment, mostly on my side, that the sound was not up to the standard that it had been. But unfortunately, the resources as we had them at the time, as well as the knowledge and understanding of how it works, and that's where consciousness comes to play, did not lend itself together in a way in which we got the correct combination that worked with the people that we're going through in California, 1,000 miles away from where I am. So that's the interesting part about this, is that it's sort of like matching everything together and making it work right. But we certainly are doing that now. And I can certainly tell the difference in listening to myself and also to the engineer who's, as I said, 1,000 miles away in northern California. So that is the secret to getting this whole thing right. I hope you can hear the difference tonight. And from now on, the shows will be at, or we'll say near or at, this quality, I hope indefinitely. Okay, so let's talk about God's plan for the development of consciousness in life. The basic part, I would say the most basic part of what we're going to be talking about is understanding what consciousness is itself. So I'm going to start off by explaining that, and let's put it into the most, we'll say, simplest explanation. One, before there's consciousness, there has to be information. Now, what is information? This information defines the difference between the one who's being informed and something else. So it provides a new spectrum to we'll call it awareness, and because the first awareness is just one's own existence. It may not be an existence that reflects on what we call self, but it does mean that the presence of one knows that one is. But that presence means nothing, or virtually nothing, if there isn't some other input coming in from other sources, because otherwise that presence would be a solipsist type of experience, meaning a singular, no other input kind of experience, and that would not be much of anything. It would be when you consider what God is looking at, God is saying, okay, I is God. What there to be? I'm being a little facetious and certainly not presumptuous. I want there to be more growth to myself, but I don't want it to be my decisions, only my creations that produces this. Because if that's the case, it is that solipsist type of experience. There's nothing really going on. It isn't something that I create entirely alone. So from that perspective, God decides that before there is any universe, before there is any life, and it says to itself, well, I need to create something that is going to be able to make decisions for itself, grow itself, and the most important thing in God's plan is to ultimately develop consciousness within itself. Now, if you can follow me so far, and I haven't defined consciousness yet because I'm going to work my way up to that, but this is an unusual step because in one respect we could say God is in a great state of sacrifice and self-limitation of its existence for the sake of birthing, if you want to call it that, we might, the entire universe. Now, this universe is God's universe of life, but it isn't the only universe that potentially exists. As a matter of fact, in Angel's Wisdom, there are at least six other universes, and probably it could be 6 zillion other universes. There's no end to the number of universes. But the important factor in this is that each kind of has its own, we'll say, way of creating a similar kind of idea. It isn't exactly the same in every universe by any stretch, and it's about different elements of what makes up, we'll call it life. The kind of universe we're in, to my understanding and the teachings in Ageless Wisdom, is the simplest form of a universe that can effectively work. That doesn't mean there can't someday be something simpler, but so far nobody's ever come up with anything simpler. That doesn't mean just because we can't, as human beings, that it couldn't be done. The simplest form has two elements to the nature of God, and that is that it is seeking produce its limitation and field through what we call thought. Thought has two elements to it. You've heard this many times. The first is creation, purpose. These are words that all are part of the first part of God's mind and consciousness in itself. So the first part is this creation. It's the ability to, we'll say, through one's self, make something that's beyond just the self, and produce in unique ways a change in the, we'll say, interactive surroundings that one is creating as well. So ultimately, this is the beginning of a self-created existence. And it happens in a field of endless possibilities and infinite possibilities. And so there is no sum total null factor or where we zero sum the amounts of all that could be by each God choosing to create something from an infinite field, because when a God does this, it creates itself to the point where it creates a different field that is separate from the one that it exists in, but it does not diminish that field in any way. Actually, in a way which is a little mathematically difficult to understand, it actually contributes to that field. But in terms of the process, the first part of God's mind is purpose, creation. Some people call it sacrifice. Some people refer to it as the the first part of what we call light enlightenment, or in many other respects, it's the absolute core of what most people would refer to as self, okay, the core of self. But it doesn't create thought until it does something very special, and that is this thought has to be in some way given in a wise way, by our standards of wise, and probably a much higher standard for God, so that the creation can't be about God's self. It has to be about something that God helps to create that goes on to create more of itself, and that we call life. And this is the requirement for there to be genuine thought. Or without this thought, God is a solipsist, exists in some kind of strange place where there's no anything, and no God would ever, in my mind, choose to do that. But, you know, anything's possible. So maybe there's a few floating around that just don't go any further. They usually refer to that as directors of fields. But a whole bunch of other things are not important to know about in respect of the corollaries that come out of these kinds of thought processes. So the bottom line is that thought means that you have to limit the field that you're in to create a new field. That new field of self-expression, weirdly, is a field of non-self-expression, or creating things that have eventually the capability of being a self, but at the same time are not completely, in most ways, are not even significantly controlled by God. This is a strange idea, and it makes for a very different outcome than most present-day religions tend to espouse, because in those religions, God is usually a deterministic being, seemingly in control of everything because its quote-unquote thought is permeating and a part of, integral part of everyone else's, all life's thought, and therefore in the minds of most religious leaders, this would take on the role of absolute and without any possibility for there being, we'll say, total free will. Now, I've heard a lot of religious people, preachers, etc., declare the opposite, say there is free will, and that the reason we, human beings, don't have ideal lives is because our free will is God's gift to us, so we can be free in very much other ways besides the mistakes we might make. Those other ways amazingly allow us to create ourselves. That's true of human beings. But tonight we're going to start with the beginnings of life and how this whole thing moves from the simplest ideas and thoughts and help from beings that we're not even familiar with for the most part, to a scale that goes beyond human. And when we examine consciousness, it starts to become the key element, eventually, in how life grows itself. And this is a kind of fascinating topic because most people are these days inundated with what is known as evolutionary ideation about how life grows. And evolution, interestingly, is a deterministic science. Now, what does that mean? Well, the presence of what I said, God making free will and going on and on about it, and self-creation is a liberating and a self-responsible platform in which to develop further theories or cosmologies, ontologies. But they are not they are not limiting. They are expanding and freeing from the inception of life. Whereas evolution suggests that life is really the product of the environment, and the environment controls life. What is the environment? The environment, by evolutionary standards, is everything that surrounds us. But isn't necessarily life itself, but some of it is. So other life and the environment causes various, over time, responses in a mechanical sense that leads to an evolutionary change. The change is mostly caused by forces, one force being against another, which produces friction and heat. And heat and friction develop into structural deformity, diseases, aging, and eventually death. But also, the forces modify and to some extent limit, and sometimes severely limit, behaviors. So the interesting thing is this model is makes us all into laboratory rats. And it doesn't ever deal with consciousness that I know. I've never seen any part of evolution explain much about consciousness. It doesn't understand consciousness because consciousness is that part of God's plan that is designed as the fruition of the great, we'll call it, universal creation of life itself and the universe itself. And that's what's missing. It's just not there. Well, consciousness, once you get an understanding of it, just blows away evolution. Evolution becomes a tactic that, to a great extent, is used by, we'll say, either non-sentient beings, which are things that aren't really truly alive, or those things that are sentient, meaning that they can respond to their environment, that the information that comes into them, they can respond to in some fashion. But that response may or may not be a conscious response. And the ultimate factors that produce this leads to a redundancy and a diminishment in the development of. Now, you could say, well, people develop selves. It's all assumed in evolution that self is just another leg in the development of evolution. Well, if that's true, under what basis does it fit within the evolutionary model? And how does it develop in such a way? And that's why these things get into a lot of philosophical arguments, but also it gives us pause to realize that the very things we're going to be talking about tonight are ill-defined, if at all, in the most, we'll say, accepted scientific models. Now, evolution does exist. It exists for the lowest forms of life as a tool, not a tool of the individual lowest life forms, not per se, as a tool of God and those beings representing godly creation, because God is not the sole creator by any stretch. He gave up most of his creation for other life to do so. But in any case, it's still the progenitor, and the plan of God permeates all higher life forms from human and up. But humans are struggling to first sense God, which they can do, and in the first form of life they can. And the sense is, not just awareness of God, because that can be in higher life, higher animal life forms, but the sense is in being conscious of God. They have some understanding of God, which animals do not. So this gives a whole different meaning when we look at this, because humans, from humans on, the development of consciousness and self and awareness with consciousness of God is a primary mechanism in God's plan. It isn't some kind of thing that just fell off the shelf because there was an evolutionary spiral leading in that direction. As a matter of fact, this unusual aspect to human beings leads to the destruction of one human or groups of humans against others. If we look at the majority of destructive acts of human beings, at least in mass, towards each other, it's because of a lack of understanding, no understanding, a lack of understanding, or a complete misperception in understanding of God. That's the bottom line. And that comes from the fact that humans, well, they have awareness and eventually consciousness of God in some cases, are free to choose not to be conscious of God or even be aware of God. And these factors cause most of the major conflicts that humans have. So this is no small thing we're in. There's a huge, huge sociological implication for what I'm telling you. And evolution is totally silent on this. It cannot explain the human element or behavior in virtually any way that's truly there that explains real events in real time. And how come this is happening? You know, people say, well, it's the experience when you were a child and you grew up this way. And I mean, you know, it's not that. People grow up all kinds of different ways and have different experiences based upon individual choices. Right. And ultimately, part of that first part of God's mind is exactly that, individual choice. But also the other side that directs the choices into a consistent pattern that draws upon and limits a field and makes that field a giving field, a wise giving field to others, which increases the ability to use the information which becomes knowledge from their senses so that they can create something new. Now, let's talk about that. Okay, we've got senses coming in as I started off. And I've been all over the place with this because I'm trying to do something more heuristically in this show tonight. I'm trying to show, through the way I'm teaching it, how consciousness is actually developed because I'm using it on you. So there you go. All right, so I'm blending in different things from all over the place right at the beginning of the show. Normally I do this systematically a little bit at a time, but tonight I'm trying something to show consciousness developed in the minds of some of you as you listen to me. So you're part of the experiment. Okay, so here's what I'm getting to. Information comes in. That is a sense. You need to have five senses of form to live in the physical world, and two senses of God's thought, we call it spirit, to be a human being. And I'm going to add a caveat. Those senses, we need to not only have an awareness externally about things, like, oh, passively information comes in, we just record it, it's there. We have to be able to reflect on it and make it, by our own choice, as either part of ourselves or rejected as part of us, and being not part of ourselves. That's our choice. The acceptance or rejection is what creates who we are. Okay, that's called consciousness. The amount that we choose or to accept the information or not is what creates our self. Okay? Now, there's an interesting part of this process. I don't want to get too far into it, but there's an interesting part of this process. We have a subconscious part, which functions below our normal level of self. Okay? And that's one way of calling it is a personality. Some people use that word. It's an older word in that context. Other people don't use it anymore. But I do. And this personality is doing something special with the information. It acts as an intermediary. And it sort of helps to limit the amount of information by making it into a fuller realm of knowledge. Now, what is knowledge? Knowledge takes the information and puts it together in a certain way so that a person can make various, we'll say, conclusionary statements about what the information means. We call that the beginning of concept formation, and can list and explain examples of that concept. That's knowledge. Knowledge is in our consciousness. But at least it helps us to organize huge amounts of information, most of which we can't use because it's overwhelming to the self. Our senses, with most people, are so good that they bring in far too much information for us to use effectively. So we need a subconscious part that sort of goes, hey, I'll take that, whatever. There's nothing wrong with that system. The only problem is the personality, being subconscious, has its own kind of sense. You could call it its own personal sense of what it is in comparison to what its self is. Now you might say, well, wait a second, that's like skitty. No, not really. Most people have a handshake relationship with their personality or subconscious mind. And for the most part, they both trust each other to some extent. However, it just doesn't always work out that way. There are rebellious attitudes the personality has. We sometimes refer to that as a disorder in it. And there are sometimes serious diseases, we call them, that are mental and or emotional, which disrupt the way the personality functions. And then there are diseases in the physical brain, that also, and the etheric part of it, which also seriously disturb its ability to communicate and function well with the self. Ooh. The self is our fully conscious part. It's the part where we take the knowledge from the personality, we being the self, and the self says, ah, this makes me, by my choice of what I'm going to either reject about me or not, or accept about me, this makes me more of me. So the self develops slowly. Now, how does it do that? Well, the first 7 years or so, the personality has full reign over the question of whether the self develops. There's virtually no self until someone's about 4 years old. Yeah, it's very hard for a three-year-old to get a large sense of self. They have a very, very minimal sense of self. But, I mean, they have a kernel. That's a good thing. But as we grow older, we develop a sense of self. And by 10 years old, most people's sense of self has reached the level where the self has grown about as much as the personality. In other words, you almost have a balance at that point. And so a lot of people will say it's really 10 and a half, or whatever you want to call it. It's midway between 7 and 14. And so when that takes place, you get into a kind of standoff situation. And the good news is, most of the time, the self wins the standoff. The person gradually, over time, overcomes the obstacles the personality may pose about being in control and in charge as it slowly relinquishes control to the development of self, and the self becomes the fully conscious being that it's supposed to be. And it may choose, over time, to bring the personality to a state of full consciousness as well. Then the two kind of join by both becoming a part of, in a conscious way, the soul. Wow, that's a biggie. Now, you notice I'm doing some really weaving here? It's very strange stuff. This isn't the way I usually teach, right? I'm just doing some experimenting. I'm bringing in a lot of different things so that your consciousness is going to start going and say, oh, what about this? What about that? Whoa. So I'm trying to expand our consciousness as we're having this, we'll say, lesson. And the interesting thing about this is that even though I'm doing it, and I'm telling you I'm doing it, even all those things happening, there could be, in a number of people who are listeners, interference coming from their personality. No matter what age we are, the personality doesn't necessarily exist in a copacetic, totally benign a completely supportive position with the self, because if it did, people would be very soul-like, and the personality would literally be joining with the soul. But very few people are in that position. So when people listen to things like I'm talking about, there could be a significant amount of interference coming from their subconscious. Because what I'm saying is doing two things. It's providing information, but I'm also trying to provide consciousness. So I'm working on two sides of the fence and trying to balance them together. So right now, in real time, I am trying to create a better balance in teaching between the consciousness of the self and the, we'll call it, controlling nature and regulating nature of the personality or subconscious. It's fascinating to watch this in discussions with people, too, and how they relate. We'll talk about that later in the show. All right, so consciousness, then, is the ability to take the knowledge of the personality and create new ways of using the knowledge that are creative and provide more understanding of new things. And the consciousness grows the most when that understanding is not only used by the self, the person itself, say, or an animal. We're going to talk about lower life forms later, but it's also amazingly best grown when that understanding is wisely given to others to help them to balance their internal side and to help them to grow. So if you teach somebody in a way in which I'm trying to do right now, that's like giving in this wise way, we hope, and it helps the teacher to grow in consciousness at the same time that all the people who are listening are growing in consciousness. Hey, this is a great system. So the system is a win-win, and there's no such thing as a zero sum, as I was talking about the same for God. There's no zero sum. The more you create and wisely give, the more the growth of all. Remember that, because in a political sense, that is the antithesis of the present political system or climate, both here in the United States and for a lot of other countries. That's the path to the destruction of self, individuality, and eventually consciousness. All right, so the process we can see now is to take the knowledge and do something that's great with it, do something amazing with it. And the result in terms of sensation in an astral sense or emotional sense is joy, at a minimum, to create consciousness. And in a etheric physical sense, the sensation is one of ease or lack of force or reduction in the amount of energy both consumed and experienced in a circumstance. In a mental sense, the result is truth and clarity, an enlightenment of the mental mind, to the point where there is effortless thought, where thought takes place in little or no time, because no time is separated from the spatial reality the person exists in. It's an amazing thing. And all this is going on because a person is becoming more conscious. Now, some people refer to conscious as being either aware of the self or unaware of. In medicine, it's sometimes referred to that way, Western medicine, because they like an on and off switch. Okay? Someone is not conscious, they can't be aware of self, so they're either asleep in a coma, or maybe they're dead. And if they're conscious, okay, but that's not consciousness, that's conscious, then they can be aware of their self, and they can interact with their environment in some way. That is not the definition of consciousness in total that I'm suggesting. That's a part of it. Actually, it's not completely wrong. It's just like taking a huge thing which consciousness is, and bring it down to the most basic but non-explanatory definition you can possibly make for it, where it has no real benefit to anybody to gain anything from. But it's easy to use, and certainly it's great if you write out a lot of death certificates every day or something. I mean, that's about its level of usefulness. Now, getting into the meat of what consciousness is, I gave you the general big picture. The meat of it is that when a person develops more consciousness, their self expands to a point where it begins to recognize that while itself is an individual, it is still part of all other selves in some ways as well. And it begins to balance those two concepts. So it never loses its individuality, but it finds that it's open to and capable of working with, taking direction from, and being humble with others. Whoa! And that is the definition of the consciousness of a soul. So we can say, well, we came from souls, right? We were a soul at one point. A piece of us, a piece of the soul, became us, incarnates, goes through several different dimensional worlds of life, and eventually goes back to the consciousness of the soul, never losing any consciousness in the process. And, you know, the only memory we lose is when it was subconscious to the self. And it was done in some ways, obviously, that would be selfish. That part, we don't actually remember. We can pretty much extrapolate it. But the point is that what we do remember is the good that we've created in going back to the soul. And so each lifetime is as rich as we have been virtuous. Fascinating ideas. So consciousness really is a huge thing. So it's like if somebody said, what would you rather have, consciousness or blank? I'll take the consciousness, thank you. Now, consciousness must work in a realm of freedom. And the other part of first part of God's mind is freedom. So another word, besides purpose and choices and will and sacrifice and on and creation, is freedom. Why is freedom so important to consciousness? Well, consciousness uses its ability to bring things together and to synthesize and to join and to create in ways that serve others. It does this, and direct, by the way, and plan, all of those things. It does this, though, in a profoundly, profoundly unique way. It can't do it by replicating what others have done. It can use that as information, what others have done. But the information is still converted into knowledge, and the knowledge is still then restructured into a wider, bigger, much greater understanding than it was originally. So each person is like a giant generator of new thoughts, new ideas, new creations that creates themselves while it creates that which they can give to others. Those are not bad things. Those are wonderful things. But there's one necessary ingredient, one ingredient that will provide this possibility. And that ingredient is freedom. If you're not free, then all of what I just said can't happen. I want you to think about that. We're going to go to break for right now, and when we come back, so much more about God's plan for the development of consciousness in life. And we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we're talking about God's plan for the development of consciousness in life. Now, it's an interesting subject, a vast subject, but the good news is we've got a long enough show to maybe make it so that people will understand this show. Yeah, it's another good thing about it. All right, so where we stopped was freedom. Freedom is the ability for each part of life to grow within its own purview or choices. So that's a definition. We can use that as an operational definition. But it's a bit more than that because freedom is also part of God's plan. And God, everything that's in God's plan is how God created the universe. So freedom is required. It's not something that you can regulate, legislate, govern, or even pretend to have the power or the right to use the power over life to abridge or remove freedom. And you can say, well, heck. Look at most governments, they limit freedom, and for the most part, they do so substantially these days. The United States was supposedly the freest country on earth, and it has chosen to limit most freedoms. So what does that mean in terms of the consciousness of life? Well, let me be specific so that we have a good understanding about this. The limitations of freedom, when they are proposed and then we'll put, say, forcibly enforced by outside parties, especially what we refer to as government, but it can be other things. Anything that governs us is directly proportional to the consciousness of individuals and the collective consciousness of the population, as well as the creation of, we'll call it, interactive exchanges. The way most people measure interactive exchanges on that size or scale is through economics. It's by far not the only way to do so. It's called the seventh ray approach. That usually, when it's not, seventh ray when it deals with the individual, and it's the third ray when it deals with the whole country. But the point is that either approach is not the only way it affects things. It affects all walks and elements of life, everything from art to the sciences, to the overall ability, we'll say, for people to be healthy and well, and to live in any meaningful way. Meaning in life is diminished directly by the lack of freedom. So the framers, the people who came together to decide what our country, the United States, was going to be like. Now, if you live in a different country and you're listening to this, it's the same thing. It doesn't matter. That, and they actually understood this concept of freedom. You need to read the Federalist Papers if you don't believe that. And it's come straight out of, strangely, ageless wisdom, what I'm teaching right now tonight, because they were in, not the majority, but about a significant number of them, say, the most influential, over half, were in a Freemasonry society. And that society is an ageless wisdom group. In other words, they study and they expressed ageless wisdom principles. One of the highest principles they had was freedom and liberty. Now, liberty is the ability to exercise freedom at the choice of a person or group of people. And they greatly espoused this as a natural and needed part of a life. And they saw that things that were governed or government was an anachronism of their age, going back to kings and queens and everything else, and also was a destructive stop sign for the development of consciousness and eventually of life and health and welfare and everything that people generally assume. They decreed through their writings and also through the construction of the Constitution that government needs to be highly limited in ways that are almost foreign to us today. Most of them by standards of today would be considered to be a moderate to middle-of-the-road libertarians. Yeah. They would not be conservative, say, Republicans as they're understood to be in the United States. They'd be a little too radical for the Tea Party. Now, that's a little hard for us to understand this because, and they had a disagreement among themselves. Hamilton was more of a conservative and less of a libertarian. But if you take others around him, they were much more radical in their libertarian aspects. And the word libertarian, of course, comes from liberty. And since liberty was one of the key buzzwords that they used, it was obvious that that's where they came from. And this is so hard for us to gather because we have come so far from that particular viewpoint that most people think that that's some form of anarchy. Anarchy just means without government. And to them, limited government is exactly what the words mean. The government is limited by the decisions of the population on a general daily basis. And the population is not limited by the government on a daily basis. The opposite is true today in the United States and almost every place else in the world since the United States is still one of the most free places you can live. It's still not much freer than many others now. So when we examine consciousness, if we don't include freedom and its liberty, you end up with a very upside-down concept. And that is that in some way, by someone telling others what to do and enforcing a kind of limitation on virtually every form of creation and every form of choice, that is in some way good, particularly when you coin it in the communistic version of social justice. This is nonsense. This is the reverse in evil of the truth. And it would have turned many of the, probably all of the framers, all of the founders of the United States, turned them into literally throwing up their hands and saying, this is not what we want. This is not what we intend. But they also recognized that if the country as a whole creates itself against the ideas that they present as its progenitors, that so be it, as they say. But the creation of such, unfortunately, when consciousness is not high enough, at least on an average level, becomes a challenge. Now, the challenge is that the present-day environment is lowering consciousness, meaning the momentum is moving further and further towards destruction of freedom and liberty, and more destruction of consciousness. Consciousness is the exchange that we need to be most concerned about in terms of the future, not only of the United States, but the entire world. It is on the decline. It is not on the incline. And that's true whether you're in the sciences, whether you're in any form of arts, and also if you're in any part of business or any part of technology creation, teaching, education. I mean, they're all in the same boat. They're reducing consciousness. Now, why is education reducing consciousness? It's supposed to be the part of the energy spectrum that deals with consciousness. It's called the second ray of energy. Why is that going down? Well, because the people going to higher educational schools, and now also high schools and some elementary schools, are being reduced in their freedom, and not taught to think for themselves or create choices, but instead being brainwashed into usually these days more, we'll call them, group conscious, so to speak, pseudo-group conscious belief structures, where giving up identity of your own interests is good, provided that the government benefits and therefore doles out and gives to other people for your sacrifices. Well, that's absolutely crazy. It's the upside down of the founders and the Constitution, the original Constitution of the United States, and even as it is today, that the Constitution is not long for existence as we know it. So we need to grasp that this whole thing that's happening here in the United States is a microcosm of a struggle of humanity to connect with and understand their own creator. Because God's plan for the development of consciousness and life is the secret for us liberating ourselves. Remember, I said, all of the major conflicts, all that I know of, and possibly most that have ever happened between any group of people, happened because of a lack of consciousness of God's plan and of God itself. And that lack of consciousness could either be a minimal diminishment, or it could be, you know, someone says, ah, God, who means God? There is no God. Just do whatever you feel, and this is it, And they could call themselves humanitarians. Well, I just want to redistribute the wealth and make sure everybody has their fair share. Well, the fair share of what? The more you give somebody something, that they haven't chosen for themselves and created themselves and use the knowledge to give to others instead of take, the more you do that, the lower their consciousness becomes. So what is it that you're really giving them? Slavery. Eventually destruction of self and destruction of human life. Other life on Earth will suffer as well, because humans have so much effect on that life these days. 1,000 years ago, not so much true. Today, yeah, big time. Whole planet could go. Why is so much put on so few? I mean, humans, okay, we've got 7+ billion people, but, you know, that's fewer than the flies, fewer than a lot of other kind of life. It's really a sort of, needed experience for the human kingdom to find on an individual level their own creator and to start functioning in the light of that creator, but within the contribution in creation through freedom, of course, of choice, themselves. That's the experience that they're looking for, but they don't know it. And that's the experience that gives the real reward, joy, and most importantly, meaning in life. It leads to the grand position of the human actually reaching a state where the conflicts that are destructive to both the self of the human being and eventually the, we'll say, lack of development of its soul, it leads from that, which is a very terrible place, to eventually the liberation of the soul to a position, we'll call it, of authority and power, to create beyond the planet that they exist on. And you say, what's got planet got to do with it? I mean, heck. Well, planets are like beings themselves. And all parts of a planet's development of life is integral. It has to do with the nature of the way God has a universe on a mini scale. The planet has a consciousness. And the consciousness of that planet isn't the physical planet. I don't think of that. This is not Wicca kind of thing. It's the consciousness of a being far beyond human that is attempting to create in unique ways, sometimes boldly trying to overcome the effects of those who have collectively gotten together that truly are on the opposite side of consciousness and are seeking to destroy life, which is God's growth, because they want to destroy God. They seek for the power of God to be theirs. We call that evil. But the interesting thing about this is that our planet has decided to make it that part of its mission. Not all planets decide that by any stretch. And all of the souls that came here are aware of this on their own level. And we as humans are here to discover it in the face of the illusion-creating principles and, we'll call them laws, that exist within the three lower worlds, the lower mental, the astral, and the physical world, where humans hang out, so that we can operate and create in these most disturbing and very difficult worlds, very difficult dimensional parts of God. These dimensional basement parts of God are sort of there because they provide the fuel for the maximum amount of growth. I know that sounds crazy. Well, growth, why can't we grow in the upper realms of the Atmic plane? Because it's here that God has limited its own thought the most, and where things such as energy take on a dimensional guise that is, by all standards, seeming like reality. And that's the reason that evolution becomes a very big, big, big subject, because it appears to those in illusion, because they don't incorporate God into their thinking, because they don't have their chakras about God, the heart and crown chakras, aren't fully conscious, aren't even close to being conscious, many people. And so their construct is in what they choose to be conscious of. And what they choose to be conscious of is there's only energy. And the energy is doing this or that to whatever and this and that, and all the forces are going on, and that's it. So to them, that's all there is. Now, you could say, well, why do souls come to a planet where the most difficult place to grow, but the most rewarding, is their job? And a part of themselves, hundreds of souls, is going to go through an incarnation to develop more in the three lower worlds and of the soul itself. The development comes from free choice to be creative and develop new and more consciousness in all life, not just in the individual, but also to create an individual of dramatic differences from all other individuals. It's so interesting. But why would they do that? Well, the soul doesn't look at it as a struggle. The soul looks at it as an amazing opportunity. Most of the souls that came to Earth because they are seeking a challenge on a level that's beyond the ones that are available in 99.75% of the rest of the planet. They know when they come here, they're going to be thrown into a meat grinder that's going to be very difficult to overcome. They accept that. And they also know that evil has its focus on this particular world, along with a few others. And so they're well aware of that. But they're willing to, we'll say, accept that, which is an uncomfortable thing, certainly, because there is nothing in their realm of understanding that will allow them to be more creative as long as they have the will to be here. There's many souls that don't. And since this is a choice made by the soul, which is hard to understand in itself, then the process is a, we'll say, one that has little, if any, reservation for most souls. Now, when a human goes wayward, living here on Earth, and in the three lower worlds, and becomes part of evil, it just loses the soul. The soul goes on. And new souls have very little input into the process, but they have the choice at the inception of it. And the choice is still theirs, regardless of how much input they're going to have, because they have too little consciousness about the three lower worlds. They may be great about the higher mental world, even have some understanding of the Buddhic monadic plane even, but they don't get what it's like in the three lower worlds, and particularly in a world like Earth, which is inundated with evil. I mean, evil darkness, darkness is just the tendency towards evil. Evil is truly dark itself. And we have this going on for ages, since virtually the beginning of human life. And before human life, there is no evil. Because evil is a choice that requires the rejection of God. And in order to reject God, you have to have some understanding of God. That's the reason I say that evil pretends that that God doesn't exist, but in reality, it believes otherwise. That's a whole other story. All right, so, fascinating stuff. The soul is going with the planet. And here we are on Earth, and we're part of that. And Earth is one of the few planets that's doing this. And we can't communicate with, nor have any, we'll say, consistent direct contact with beings that are more advanced than us. Why? Well, two reasons. First, the evil dark beings, there's some of those, that would like to have contact with Earth, are prevented from doing so by the good guys, for the most part. It all depends on how evil Earth becomes at any particular relative time in history. But the other thing is that we really developed humans from other worlds, and those who have developed from other planes of reality with this world try to step aside. They know that if they interfere very much in the interactions and workings of humans while they're incarnate, they bring with that a potential of reducing freedom and affecting the growth of consciousness. They don't want to do that. Now, in the past, they would do so in various, we'll say, esoteric, hidden ways, and they could get away with it. These days, that's not really a good way of going ahead. Technology in the 1920s and 30s moved so far ahead, as well as in many other respects, people reached a point in mental development where, in order to have contact, would give humans too much further knowledge that accompanied whatever consciousness came directly from those we were advanced than us, leading to a potential destruction of the world. So in order to protect humans, there needed to be a little cutoff, for the most part, of very much communication. And only those who were past something called the renunciations during the third level of initiation would have contact. And the rest would just could read about if they wanted to or talk to others who might have contact, but they couldn't have direct contact. And the reason being that it could lead to this terrible possibility of destruction of the world. It actually happened a time or so before, general time, not a specific time, during another age, the Atlantean age. That's a whole other story, but it happened a long time ago. And when it did, I mean, we're talking like half a million years ago. When it happened, it led to the eventual, it took a long time, the slow, gradual decline, eventually destruction of that civilization. And part of the destruction at the end of it was enacted by the very beings we're talking about. So, I mean, it's a terrible consequence, and nobody wants that again. So we have a sort of built-in protection mechanism. Now, does that mean that they were interfering with our free will? Sort of. Yeah, I mean, you reach a point where it's going to be, without question, destruction of an entire world, and what can you do? And sometimes you let the world be destroyed, and sometimes you intervene depending upon which has the greatest potential for the development of consciousness, in not just the planets we're talking about, but the whole universe. There's a balancing act, and it's not so easy to figure. From our perspective, you need a wider perspective looking at how Earth fits in with the solar system, which is just a point of light, a star, but how that fits in with that, but then how it also fits in with groups of stars in the galaxy and other galaxies and beyond. It's too big for us to really comprehend because there's, I mean, billions, millions of galaxies. Each galaxy has billions and billions of stars. And how many planets? Oh, my. I mean, it's like the numbers we can't even fathom. And so that's the reason it's too big of a concept for us to hold together and see all of the more individual reasons for going one way or another in a particular direction. All right, so where does that put us? That puts us to how does all of this affect the life plan for the development of consciousness? And I'm going to use Earth as an example, of course, because we're familiar with it. But I want you to be aware from what I've just explained to you that this is not a formula for other planets. We are about as unique as most other worlds can be. We're unique not because we're great. We're unique because we're horrible. Now, horror has within it the seeds for enlightenment and for eventual greatness. And that's what our souls know. But we as humans have learned to accept the horror. There was a recent program on the History Channel, and it was the history of mankind. Well, it would be better probably calling it humankind, but I don't know. But I guess they're going back to man or whatever. But the thing is about it is if you look at about 90% of that series, it's about all of the destructive things that one group of humans did to another. Now, how is that? How does that really affect those who are watching it? Well, if you're a child, you might come to the conclusion, well, the neatest thing about this program is watching everybody get their butts kicked, and yeah, oh, how many people will we kill this time? And which weapon is the more effective weapon to kill more people? No discussion about what's really happening and the underlying aspects as I'm bringing up in tonight's show, that this is a lack of understanding one's own creator. And not recognizing God and or God's plan in any correct or meaningful way. The process evolves over and over again. It repeats itself because that's the basic problem. You don't get much of that by watching that particular show. As a matter of fact, I had trouble for the most part watching it. There were some interesting thoughts of the interesting things that were new that I hadn't heard before. But the problem was it all moved in a single direction, and that seemed to be, when is the next battle going to occur? Who's going to be the most violent one? I mean, and of course, it's not untrue in terms of facts and history, but it doesn't get to the truth of what really is happening. To me, history needs to be something more than a bunch of incidences. History needs to have behind it the truth about the plan that history is actually interacting within. And that's what's missing. You could say those folks are probably pretty evolutionary in their thought processes. But okay, so as we examine this, then we can say that, wow, Earth is a mess. Look at any part of history in Earth, and it's promulgated with huge amounts of violence and destruction of life and destruction of civilization and properties and you know, nature and anything you can think of. Wow. Well, with all that going on, it doesn't give one a lot of assurance that the future is going to be a lot better. Now, I'm going to tell you, our future right now is tenuous. Where we're going to be, say, 100 years from now, may be a coin flip. Not based upon happenstance, but based upon the ideas of development of consciousness, including freedom and liberty, and many other key elements, and whether those things will root and take form, or they'll be expelled. And as soon as they're expelled, you could just about kiss Earth goodbye. One generation can do it. It's hard to understand this. And everybody says, well, there'll be a civil war, there'll be a revolution. Yeah, there probably will, but that doesn't solve the problem. All it does is take on the mask of people not seeing the truth. And there'll be another History Channel series about that part of Earth's development, maybe 200 years from now. You see, that's the problem. We just aren't getting it. Maybe we need Studs Terkel to give us the angle from the street, so to speak. Some kind of more living history and some kind of greater consciousness has to come through. Now, does that mean that there's going to be that? There's going to be a sudden expansion in consciousness and the evils of today will be dealt with and, you know, what was originally the plan of some great thinkers and conscious people 700 years ago will finally become real? I don't know. That's a really good question. And the outcome, some of us may see. Truly. All right, so let's talk about life in God's plan for Earth. When we go back to the beginning, you know, 3.8 billion years ago or so, life is created by God making sure that a planet like Earth has sufficient quantities and ways of producing certain kinds of nucleic acids, proteins, and allow those, we'll call them non-living things, they aren't alive, under the circumstances of and direction of God's plan to attempt on their own to make a choice. Now, you need to understand the difference here between a human being making a choice and a molecule of either DNA, or some people nowadays are calling XNA, because there's other ways to make DNA, but DNA, which comes from RNA, ribonucleic acid, and deoxyribonucleic acid DNA. But the where this can actually choose to do something, it seems a little bit impossible for us to accept. That's why so many people say, oh, it couldn't be true. It's just a bunch of chemicals, and the chemicals eventually, by accident, combine and make a choice. Whoops, no, couldn't be that. Never mind, I didn't say that. No. No, I'm an evolutionary biologist. Okay, if they didn't make a choice, then how did some things happen and other things be rejected? In other words, eventually, by what is called nullification theorem, if everything is happening by happen chance, whatever you create, be it life or otherwise, out of chemistry, will be nullified eventually by the counter to it. Yeah, it's true. I know you have trouble maybe believing that, but it's true. You can mathematically prove what I just said. So, and as a matter of fact, life is at a huge disadvantage because it has a very narrow range in relative terms of what it can do at the beginning of its creation. And, yes, it can develop all kinds of what are called adaptive things, but the whole question of life is that it has to make a choice, and each choice has to allow it to survive in an environment that has not yet developed. Or if it didn't do that, it would be wiped out. It has to be ahead of the game. Well, how in heck does life do that? Well, I'm going to tell you how it does. The life that we're talking about, those little one-celled, sort of, so to speak, organisms eventually, before there was one cell, there was RNA. Let's talk about the RNA. Okay. RNA. What is RNA? Ribonucleic acid. And there's xRNA, which could be four or five or six other kinds of chemicals that resemble RNA. But anyway, those kinds of chemicals are being directed by something that's greater than themselves. Wow. Now, the direction is not to make the choices for the chemicals. It's only providing the chemicals with a sense of how to connect together so that if they seek to be more of themselves in a weird chemistry way, they can choose to do so by the encouragement of a thing called a group soul. Now, what is a group soul? Well, it's a more conscious being again. And what we have to understand is that life doesn't come from the bottom up as we think it does. It comes from God down, which means that higher life is actually there before there is lower life. And that's the part we don't understand. So, yeah, group souls. Group souls start working with all kinds of, we'll call it chemicals and elements. And eventually, the group soul gets together with beings who are pure energy. They don't even exist in any form, per se. They can take on the appearance of a form, but they're actually more energy. So they work with these spirit beings, if I call them, because they are usually more spiritually motivated beings, but they evolve, if you want to call it that, in a way in which they become more form-sensitive and specialized and not just a bunch of energy as they grow in consciousness. Totally the opposite of where we grow. And so they're all attempting to allow chemicals, RNA in this particular case, to be able to start making choices. Now, how do nucleic acids actually make a choice? Ribonucleic acids, I mean, that's what it is, nucleic acid. It's a protein. How does it make a choice? Well, it makes a choice by how it folds itself. This is going to sound unbelievably strange, but it has to do with something in quantum physics, but that when it folds itself in one direction in comparison to another, there aren't the same outcomes. In one direction, if it folds itself, it becomes something entirely different than another direction. Its color may change. Its spin, if it's spinning parts of its atoms, may change. There's considerable changes in the process of the way it interacts with other atoms, chemistry, chemicals, elements, and even down to subatomic particles. Now, you start saying, well, wait a second, if all this is down to even subatomic particles, there must be zillions of ways that chemicals that we call some of them elements and some of them compounds could interact. That's true. But the difference is that a protein is able to do this kind of folding. And what does folding do? Well, folding matches the dimensionality of the dimension that the life form is in this world. The dimensionality of this world is height, width, and breadth, and time. And so it folds in ways that affects height, width, breadth, and time. And this changes its experience with other chemicals. And in a way in which the choice that it's making is to become something greater than what it was, it chooses to fold in ways that matches but not copies the folds of other nucleic acids. Matches but does not copy. Until it wants to give something back. And then when it does that, we call that giving birth, and it creates a new life form that is free from it to do its thing. Does that sound like God's plan? It sure does, doesn't it? You see, And how does it shoot? Well, when we do experiments in the laboratory, we try to stimulate RNA, and mostly DNA experiments, to do this. And it just doesn't work. There is the problem. The reason it doesn't work is there's no group soul behind the experiment encouraging the DNA to fold in different ways. Ooh. What if we were to do that? What if we were to go in and say, hey, you know, DNA, it's time to start folding in a unique way. Well, we'd have to learn how to communicate that way, and we haven't done that because we don't yet understand it completely. Our consciousness, which is another word for understanding, is not great enough to be able to do this yet. So we can create DNA, in a sense, but we can't create DNA that creates more DNA, or that is able to match and grow life. So we can make a kind of building block of life, but we can't actually make life. And this is fascinating. Most people think we've made life for years. Oh, 1950, some guy at the University of Chicago put a bunch of chemicals in a tube and lightning and this and that, and all kinds of nucleic acids all over the place. It oozed everywhere. It got brown. And yeah, but it wasn't life. Great. Life is the key. And life has to have choice. And choice has to be allowed to happen. At the same time, in allowing it, you have to be an encouragement of life. You have to be willing to give something to that life, which gives it more freedom. And when you put it in a glass flask and you do all these other things to it, you may be decreasing its freedom, not increasing it. Okay, so this is a fascinating subject, isn't it? Okay, so when we look at this from that standpoint, God's plan is right there. We can see it, but as humans, we can't do it. Will we ever be able to do it? Yes. In order to do it, we need to have, quote-unquote, biologists, scientists, geneticists, who are going to and are willing to incorporate the concepts of God's plan in their science. And it'll work. It will, really. But you've got to give freedom to the nucleic acids. And that's such a jump. That's such a vastly different concept than you can explain to most scientists who take rats and dissect them every day and, you know, give them cancer and breed them so they get more cancer faster so they can do their experiments better. I mean, these are the folks you're going to try to explain to them that you got to give freedom to the chemicals. Nobody's got it, right? All right. So it's a process in which you provide the environment, you produce the desired building blocks, and you let the chemical, the DNA, or whatever you're using to do it on its own. And you provide many different temperatures, many different possibilities, and you let it find its own way. Wow. That isn't the way science works, though, because then you have no independent variable. Because the independent variable has to be controlled by, quote-unquote, scientists. So, by definition, it becomes an art rather than a science. Something to consider. Something very important to consider. All right, so these first one-celled, some of them weren't even cells. They were first RNA. Eventually, the RNA found a way to make a membrane around itself using other parts of proteins and fats and some sugars. And part of them went off and created eventually bacteria, and others became like mold-like things, and others became plants. That's a biggie, plants. And then others became what we're beginning to point is that this process that we are into right now is continually involving more and more choices that are totally, totally veiled. We don't see them. We don't understand them. But if you are Francis Crick, who actually won the Nobel Prize for discovering DNA with his associates, he said that if you look at the time necessary for life to have created a DNA in a strictly, we'll call it, chance circumstances, there two things happen. It would take 5 to 10 times longer than the time we had, with less crises, and it wouldn't have worked anyway because of all the crises that took place on Earth, including the snowball attack and the other things. It would not have prepared itself for future events. It couldn't have, because it would be continually adapting to the environment it's in, but it wouldn't have enough time to adapt to the sudden changes which took place. And the results are that over time, life would be extinguished, and it would not grow through the adaptations of evolution, because the forces would be too great. The problem with evolution is the forces grow exponentially as time goes by. So the greater the time, the more chance that something won't exist eventually, evolutionary-wise. So the process doesn't work, and he explained this mathematically, why it wouldn't work out. So you get into this question, okay, then where are all the other choices coming and how are they happening? Well, the choices for life to become more abundant and free to grow itself and to finger out into all kinds of creative areas, and isn't that exactly what happened? Doesn't that follow God's plan? Yeah. Remember, the bacteria form two different kinds of bacterias, some that grow on their own, some that get together and form a cell themselves. The bacteria go on and do their thing for millions of years, millions, even over a billion years. But the interesting thing is they also start changing the environment, eventually to the way they could develop a new kind of life, but a kind of life that will destroy most of the bacterial life as they existed ages ago. A little bit of them could remain, but if they didn't morph, so to speak, into this other life that had to be developed over hundreds of millions of years of time, then it would not have, the system would not be sustainable. It would collapse. All right. This is the greater consciousness. Expanding your consciousness by looking at things in a new and a completely, we'll say, amazing way. Life now is taking on the ability to plan, and consciousness and planning are part of the same thing, plan 100 million years ahead with the help of the group soul and beings that we sometimes refer to as spirit beings, some of whom are solar angels. They're on the energy side of existence. And they're trying to help the group soul deal with the environmental, quote-unquote, energy problems, while at the same time the group soul is attempting to make sure that life is continuing to make choices by being given the freedom to do so. It's an amazing process. And you throw in with that all of the difficulties that Earth as a certain type of planet has, and it makes life extremely tough and resilient, but also difficult for life to grow in. Tough place. All right, so consciousness comes from choices, and even atoms, molecules, proteins exhibit choice. Subatomic particles exhibit choice. Oh, you're saying, oh, that guy's just hallucinating. He must be talking about stuff. Listen to him. He's crazy. They have known, they being physicists, have known that subatomic particles exhibit choice since about 1900, and it was proven by 1925. Yeah. Proven. So, is this nutty? If subatomic particles are exhibiting choice, whoa. Now, I'll tell you this. One of the things that was discovered is that subatomic particles, the only time they don't exhibit choice is when they're influenced by thought, by humans or higher, sometimes even aliens. Yeah, thought, planning, consciousness, all come to bear on choices, and they affect subatomic particles. Now, if you have a greater amount of mass than a subatomic particle does, you have to have greater thought, but to have an effect. So you got to have a group soul to have an effect on cells, because a group soul is way more conscious than the cell in relative terms, but and far more conscious than humans are today. And that's hard for us to understand. Why is a group soul more conscious than a human? Because a group soul exists in the higher mental world, and we only use a small part of the higher mental world to sometimes, infrequently at best, think. We don't live our lives by it. These beings live in it. So their consciousness is a multiple of, we'll call it, the higher mental world's ability to excite and move the creative conceptual ability of beings that exist there. All souls exist in that world. Our soul does too. And when we become our soul, we become brilliantly more conscious. But it's not common today. We need it to be more so. Soul infusion, big part of growing. All right. Eventually, these cells become able to make choices to get together, because some of the cells say, hey, I become an individual, pretty cool, everything. But some of them want to grow something greater than themselves, but don't want to do it by just increasing themselves. They want to do it with others. And collectively, this starts off with two different kinds, we could call it, of life. Some life stays more individually focused. Other kinds of life become colonized. And eventually, the colonies adapt and become organized, meaning that they don't just grow together as a bunch of cyanic, you know, bacteria. They eventually grow together as individual parts of each other. And this comes from replicating what went on in the cell. The cell itself had specialization. And as it became specialized, it said, why not do this with other cells? And it also did it with other things, like bacteria would go inside a cell and create something new, a new kind of cell. Wow. Didn't know that? Yeah, that's a theory, but it seems to be right. So all the, and when they combine, they bring their RNA and DNA together, and they make new choices. You never give up the choices of the lowest form of life as you grow new life. You only add to that more and more, greater, bigger, more accepting choices from greater levels of awareness. Remember, awareness comes from what? Senses. So as the senses grow, the life form becomes amazingly more complex. Yet, you have the bigger life form with a sense and a consciousness, with all the smaller elements of life, going all the way back to the most primitive self, still existent within it. Isn't that what we are? Yeah. Now, all of this kind of development is only relevant to life that exists within the three lower worlds where humans inhabit. it's not really relevant in the conceptual framework of the mental world, and especially not relevant in the formless world of the Buddhic realm and beyond. So in these circumstances, and when I say formless, I should say they do have form there, but it doesn't dominate the nature of existence. So it's really not formless, it's formless. Formless, not without form. So there's this incredible, challenge, because humans are concentrated in the place where energy takes on the dominant issue, and where we are in a contest, so to speak, with forces around us to attempt to make choices that are more godly when the world seems to not support our fluid, easy way of doing it. Until we learn and become conscious of God enough that it's only through following God's overall plan that things do become effortless. If we avoid or, worse, work against God's plan, the efforts become enormous. Now, we can shift them to other people for a while. That's evil. And let them pay the consequences. But eventually, because of the laws of karma, we can't withhold it. Because it takes more and more forces, more and more energy, that we eventually can't garner from the people we destroy, enslave, etc., to allow us to have enough power to keep ourselves in existence if we go down that road. And so, you can become godlike for a short time if you want. I got all the power. I'm president of the blank, and I can do anything I want. Well, yeah, but in the scheme of things, evil has little that it remains of its existence for very long. And evil in the long haul will never remain in existence. Now, it doesn't want to accept that, and so I guess it will find out the hard way. But the problem is in the math. It becomes exponentially more and more difficult to gain enough power. Power is the ability to do things, to interrelate with things. It gives you the ability to control. It gives you the ability to prevent others from controlling. It gives you the ability to exercise your own choices. And if you see it fits to do so, to limit the choices of others. Evil does that, limits the choices of others. But every time you do that, you put yourself in a conflict, and the result is the sum total is a negative. It's only the illusion of time and the separation of time from space that convinces evil that, at least for a small amount of its time in existence, it has power over others and can do what it wants. That is a true statement, but it's for such a limited period of time, it's going to spend millions of years proving the opposite to itself. This is the amazing thing about God's plan. While it gives us freedom, and freedom to even become evil, it has the dice loaded. The end product, the end of the situation, is no matter how many planets actually go evil, the universe will turn itself around, and God's plan will prevail. Not because God's controlling, but because God gives freedom, and freedom trumps slavery, and darkness, and power controlling evil. Freedom trumps it because freedom grows life in consciousness, evil destroys life in consciousness, and evil is both alive and conscious, so eventually destroys itself. Okay, that's enough for evil, I guess. But the point is that when we look at the plan, and we see how this plan is constantly evolving from the RNA to cells to eventually the most profound expressions of life, which we eventually call human, and then to beyond. Now, why are humans such a big deal in all this? Well, partly because, as I explained, we developed the senses to be able to first be aware of our own creator, and then to be aware of the creator's plan, its purpose, why, what it's about, and then to use that as a model for how we're going to choose and create things, not to replicate it. You can't replicate virtue. You've got to create new virtue. And you've got to create new enlightenment, new you. Now, we either create ourselves into new beings that are greater than human, or we move into darkness, and eventually, if we stay in there long enough, we will move into evil. If you go into evil, eventually you will reverse your humanity until you can't operate in a human body anymore. You may maintain some levels of humanity in some aspects of yourself, but those aspects will be embodied in a plant or an animal body for eons, for much longer than you're evil, to get back to the through the same process that you eventually got. In the first place, you've got to turn all of those bodies into more sensing, more awareness that are accurate, more freedom for those species, all the way up back to humans, again, before you can get out of your own entrapment in form. Because the consciousness cannot exist without form in the three lower worlds. That's the definition of them. And evil is trapped by that law. Interesting idea. The law was made by God. God said, let there be light and let there be darkness. If life so chooses, but in those choices, it is incumbent upon all life that if it chooses to destroy other life, if it chooses to be in darkness and eventually evil and to destroy God, it will eventually destroy itself in its form nature. Consciousness is never taken away or removed by God. Never. Or by the soul. Or by anything else that's in light. It never removes consciousness. So all the consciousness that remains in the evil one continues on. But it continues on in the form that the consciousness can have the most expression, and the consciousness is so low it drops to levels that are unbelievable. Imagine having your conscious bad person, and your consciousness is so low that the most you can be is a fly, or maybe a worm. Maybe you'd make a nice tulip. But regardless, the point is that you might have to go through millions of lifetimes of those kinds of existences to express anything of your consciousness. And in the meantime, you're imprisoned in this form. And you actually have some level of humanity in the suffering that you go through. And it takes way over a million years on an average for this to work itself out. So an evil person may spend thousands of years being evil, but spend millions of years getting back just to the place where they have a human body. And, of course, when they do, they want a human soul, too, because you can't evolve a human body once you've lost it, and you don't have the power to steal enough energy from others to keep it together. It's called crystallizing. You can't do it anymore. And rarely, I mean, actually, it's happened a few times, not here on Earth that I know of. Someone gets all the way back to that point, gets the human body, and they get back to the evil thing again. It becomes destructive. Oh boy, you're talking about stupid. And those people don't last thousands of years. They might last a few hundred years, and then they're back again because they haven't developed enough power skills to be able to deal with the destruction of their consciousness. And each time it's a little worse. Wow. Talk about a nasty set of karmic circumstances. Well, that's the way the universe is. It's not punishment. It's the result of destroying consciousness. Now, we have to look all around us. Who's destroying consciousness? Well, I gave you a formula for that towards the beginning of the show. Let that be your guide. Listen and look at all those who are seeking power and control, who are reducing freedom, who are enslaving people, who are giving not only unwisely, but giving in ways to reduce the consciousness of all they give to. So they're not just making a mistake, they're doing it with a plan. That's evil. That's real evil. And look around and you can see it happening. But you have to open not just your mind, but your heart to God. And then with God's plan, you can see the evil. The weird thing about evil is evil positions itself, its best defense is to be invisible. And how is it invisible when it doesn't, it's exercising power and everything else? It has learned two ways. The first is to develop a great deal of fear in people on an emotive scale, astral level, to get people to be afraid of accepting that people are evil. In other words, just the belief and understanding that evil exists, evil makes people afraid of, because they make that into either an outrageous belief structure or a unreasonable, untenable one, unscientific, unloving, socially unjust. All of these things it uses. And then on that's the astral level. But then on the, and it also uses the composite's other side of it, which is, gee, you need to help us, the evil folks, give more to those who don't have, so that we can all be the same and get rid of this business of individual this and that, as though that's going to do any good. Against God's plan, right? Okay, so then the other side of it is mental. And mental evil today is a whole different... Oh, there's another side to the astral evil, and then it's fear itself, fear of power, force, and the desire to gain some level of security. That evil uses that too. But now, when you move to the mental side, this is relatively new. It's only been in relatively recent historical accounts that we see evil growing that way. Their evil destroys by lies and propaganda and destroying truth and changing the truth into lies and lies into truth. Gets people to believe things that are absolutely untrue and to make that the foundation of the consensus of conceptual thought and all the thought forms that supposedly are supported by it. So what eventually happens is that the examples that evil uses are examples of evil itself, yet they convince people that that's good. Whoa! And people go along with it. Why? Because of egotism. So many people have become egotistical, unfortunately, in society, that they don't want to be wrong. Evil says, everybody that follows us is right, and you don't even have to think or do anything. All you got to do is be a follower. Well, people say, well, that's easy to do. I like ease. This is a very forceful world I live in. That would be much easier to do. Where do I sign up? Well, here's the Communist Manifesto. Put your name on that. And here's a treatise on how to become a dictator. Finisher on that. Here's a book that was written by Machiavelli. Make sure you read it. Here's some other books published by many other solitary leaders and some aspiring dictators around the world. take those and study those, and then join the revolution. The revolution is that now you're part of us, so we can use force on others to get them to do what's good for them. And what's good for them is, of course, what's good for us. So come on board. And that's part of the seduction. The rest of it is that people don't want to have to figure out what their life's about. They like someone telling them what to do sometimes. And what the heck? If all you got to do is just do those things and somebody's going to provide you food, shelter, and clothing, it may not be exactly what you want, it may be what you choose, but heck, if you got a bad life already anyway because you haven't been very creative, this makes sense. So you give up your creativity, but you never were very creative in the first place. Well, there you go. Just join in. Now, evil's been doing this for a long time, but it's become an art and a science since about the turn of the last century. It became propagandized because of technological changes, which allowed the lies to be to permeate every part of the culture over and over again, almost immediately. We had newspapers and books, etc. But then we moved into the telegraph and telephone and radio and television and satellites and the movies and videos and you name it. Right? So it has allowed those that have become the most hideous of evil to present themselves in the suit of goodness by using propaganda. Lying almost every day, and the lies are ridiculous lies, but because they completely contradict what the person said maybe a day before, but certainly a month before. So the results are you end up with people actually forgetting what the prior statements were, the prior thoughts were. How come that happens? Well, because there's a strange thing about the mental world. The mental world's dimensionality includes the whole dimension of time. If you can infiltrate the mental world and get through to people's mental mind, not just their mental brain, their mind now, and you can constantly tell them things that have the past left out of it and just tailor it to the present with a fake future. And they can't compare the future to the past, so you don't have any truth. You've got a great system of propaganda for creating in the minds of people anything you want. And what you want is you want power and control over God, which eventually you can get if you can control all the people, all the life, because the people control other life, and then you got control of the world. And you fight to get that, control of the world. It's an interesting idea. And why do people go along with it? Because they have lost their ability to sense part of the mental dimension through the forces imposed by their own egotism. Once you become egotistical, you become resistant to seeing the whole part of time. Therefore, truth starts to escape from you. And so the people who are most prone to be propagandized are the people by evil, are the people who are egotistical. And those folks fall right in line. They say, yeah, okay, where do I sign up? So, and the people who are open-minded, who are not egotistical, seldom are swayed by propaganda. The problem is that it's about a 3 or 4 to 1 ratio of people who are somewhat, if not a lot, at this time in history, right today, who who are egotistical and or arrogant compared to the rest remaining 20-25% of the population that isn't. Well, that's bad news, because propaganda can be extremely effective in that. Now, there's another interesting thing. 25% of a population is reaching the level of what is known as consciousness of God. 50% of the population or more has firm belief in God, and 80% believes in some religious viewpoint. So when you look at this, you start saying, well, what is the difference? If you're not in a way, if you have a concept of God, 50%, and why is the 25% isn't? Well, between the 25% that are gaining an understanding of the plan of God, 25%, you can find all these numbers in a book I wrote called Life's Hidden Meaning, a textbook. But God's plan is one thing. That's the 25%. Yet the 50% of the people who say, yeah, there's no question there is God. Okay. Yeah. But they don't. But the other 25% don't get what God's plan is. And then you got another 30%. Now, these are real numbers here in the United States I'm talking about. It's most countries, by the way. There are a lot of them are similar. It's not just the United States. Most countries that are quote-unquote first world or whatever that means, where people are relatively educated. Education does not mean that you're necessarily not egotistical. It means many times the reverse. So the point is that when you get to the point where the remaining 30%, they go by astral. They call it faith, but they go by how they feel. And it doesn't matter what they think. So they can be persuaded by fear, by force, by other things to go along with some forms of propaganda. But unfortunately, it's the 25% or so of the folks that truly believe in God for mental reasons, but they don't have an understanding great enough to know what God's plan is. Those are the folks that are tipping the scale, and that's causing some great difficulties. All right, so we have 1 out of 4 people who are conscious enough to maybe read a book like Life's Hidden Meaning, or listen to the show, or a lot of other things. Well, that's not bad. I mean, it's still a large group of people. Why aren't they doing something? Well, then you have the other issues that get into play. And that is that you still have to be able to see evil. And seeing evil is not just being in that 25%. You've got to be overcoming your own fears. You've got to work at improving your spiritual senses. You've got to do certain things to discipline yourself in enough ways so that your senses improve to the point where they're working well enough. You can be aware of what's going on. It's a lack of awareness. All right. But nonetheless, those numbers, as I've just explained them, make every bit of sense. And if you take a look at it, I generally am throwing them out. And of course, these are not exact. It's not like, oh, it's right to the number. I just throw out some general ideas that are going on. And it's like that in a lot of countries. Don't think that, oh, well, that's just the United States. No, it's not. It's a whole bunch of countries like that. Even in the most disadvantaged of countries, egotism is still a problem. It is just not as great a problem. When egotism becomes the problem, it's usually because the educational system of the society, instead of helping people to create choices and to be creative and helping them to be freer thinkers, does the opposite. And when families don't stand up for that, the opposite of that, and it says there should be freedom, then the family structure with the educational system leads to disaster. And you've heard me talk about that before, and I don't need to belabor it tonight, but the point is, that's where we're headed if we don't watch it. Okay, so the plan goes on. The plan goes on and develops enormous numbers of different kinds of animals in life, but consciousness is growing in the process. As we look at this growth throughout the ages, very complex awareness and organisms are developed. microscopic cellular life. Some of it is between kingdoms, but and therefore they don't exactly fit in either kingdom, and they're on their way to either become animals or become plants. In those, we have molds and bacteria still doing their thing, because they still remain as a sort of, we'll say, afterglow of the kinds of things that they eventually developed, which is more complex life. But some of that still remained. Other kinds became extinct, as you well know. But the extinction process is not an extinction of life, per se. It's an extinction of form. So today we've got chickens and some kinds of birds that are basically the life of dinosaurs. But it's a life that is more conscious in some respects, but not as necessarily intelligent. Intelligence is a different aspect. Intelligence is the ability to use senses to produce high amounts of knowledge. But dinosaurs were never as conscious as a chicken. How do you know that? How do I know that? Well, the chickens are much more capable of creating new understanding. They're much more trainable. They take direction far better. And you say, well, why don't dinosaurs take direction? You know, well, we don't know for sure, but based upon what we can discern from what we've discovered about the dinosaurs, they were creatures with reptilian types of, we'll call it, motivation. The reptilian motivation is to please the astral nature by mechanisms called the reticular activating system and the hypothalamus, the mid part of the brain, ignoring most of the cerebral parts of the brain most of the time. That doesn't mean that reptiles don't have some level of consciousness. It just means that the dominant element of dinosaurs was to work by what we'll call the senses of feeling, astral nature, along with instincts coming from their group souls and coming from a minimal amount of knowledge that they created from their world with limited consciousness. They had amazing ways, because of a lot of knowledge they developed, of interaction. But most of their forms of interaction were not to give to other dinosaurs, or particularly any other life form, but rather to, we'll say, dominate and control their environment. They were the peak, in some respects, of some evolutionary theories. But they also were the spawning of new kinds of more conscious life in a whole round of change in the Earth's development, in which intelligence and the focus of intelligence in animal life and some other kinds of life as well moved from that to the focus of consciousness. That doesn't mean the dinosaurs had no consciousness. I just said they weren't as conscious as chickens. The most conscious of dinosaurs were the dinosaurs that were most likely, in some respects, the most giving of dinosaurs. Well, which ones were those? It's hard to say. There were certain omnivores, meaning that they ate both meat and plants, that seemed to have that nature to them, based upon some of the ways they grew. Some people look at the raptors, you know, the velociraptors, the uniprotodonts, those are little ones, there's bigger ones. But these kinds of dinosaurs were more intelligent, but they were certainly nowhere near the level of consciousness of a chicken. Their brains are actually bigger than chickens. But brain size and consciousness is not the same thing. The brain size is the ability to contain, in some respects, content of information. And for creatures that live a long time, that may be an important thing, short-time life really isn't even a hindrance. But at any rate, that brain is not consciousness. Consciousness comes from the mind. And the mind is developed not just in the ethereal physical realm, but also the astral. As I said, dinosaurs had that going for them for sure. And they had some mental development. But their mental development was predominantly in the sixth and seventh sub-worlds of the lower mental world, which puts it into the element of feeling good, having some level of, we'll say, interaction with other dinosaurs, which included sexual development for most of them. And it was a way of expression that is unique to the whole species of dinosaurs, in a sense. Many of them had a similar kind of, we'll say, flavor of life. Their flavor of life was high levels of intelligent activity leading to very powerful results, especially in their structure, but also in their ability to control their environment and even adapt to their environment. But what they missed was consciousness. Consciousness would have given them the ability, we probably don't want dinosaurs who are more conscious, but would have given them the ability to be more creative. So adaptation is one thing. Creation would be the dinosaurs get together and start building houses and bridges, and before long they have airplanes and satellites and that sort of stuff. Well, we don't expect that dinosaurs ever got to near that level, nor could they probably have, because long before they reached that point, with the level of power that they had already developed in themselves, they would have destroyed themselves. Human beings with much less power within themselves, and actually not even sometimes all the intelligence that some of the dinosaurs have shown, have almost destroyed themselves a number of times. Could you imagine if you put that same kind of twist into the dinosaur? That could be one heck of a bad combination. They'd destroy themselves. But they didn't, because the lack of consciousness allowed them to live longer than any other kind of life form has yet lived on Earth. About 180 times or so longer than what present-day science believes. But in reality, it's more like about, give or take, maybe 20 times. But regardless, it's still a lot. They lived a long time in terms of controlling and dominating the environment. And that's what it's about when you get to this level of intelligence. They dominate and they become powerful. And that's what they were doing because they were along what's called the third ray, which because it was in the third round of development, focusing on this intense level of interaction and energy. We're in that fourth round, which is the kind of thing where we're trying to find ways to build through civilization, through the collective efforts of us working through consciousness. It's a totally different element. Now, does that mean that it's the only way we can express consciousness? No, humans can express it seven ways. Dinosaurs had one way. Their way was the third ray, except for certain exceptions in their species. They'd always have to have some exceptions or else there's no ability to grow very much. But the exceptions were minor in comparison to the way they generally existed. You see, you can only go so far and be a reptile, and that's it. Dinosaurs were it. Any further, they destroy themselves, so it wasn't going to help to just let them live longer. They were already declining, even when they got wiped out. And so looking at it from the perspective of how God's plan works, life is there to not evolve. Life is there to get closer and closer to being its creator. Every part of life is exhibiting another fractional part of God. every part, every piece, what we call evolutionary development, well, nobody really sees the real evolution, it seems. Some people do, but most scientists don't. That the real evolution is in recognizing and co-creating, becoming God, a part of it. And this is what's so amazing about this process. God's plan is to develop life that understands and interacts and becomes part of God's plan. That's the neat thing about it. And it works when you read and you immerse yourself into all the different kinds of life that has been on this planet. It starts gelling. You start saying, wait a second, this is all fitting together. The story of life is telling the story of God. But we're not open to it. The real history of mankind, just one part of life, is a history of God, God's plan. Now, I know they got a version coming out about the Bible. That's going to be very interesting. The Bible is the misinterpretation of God's plan. But it's an interesting book nonetheless. A lot more wars, a lot more people killing each other. It is that same mistake that is almost inbred into us, that somehow greatness comes from power, control, and the dark side. Never true, but always an interesting lie. All right, so getting back to where does this process then take us, since we're trying tonight to talk about how God's plan eventually is meant to go, besides just where it historically has come from, right? And the eventual goal is for all of us that are human, obviously. We are here to create new ways, unique to each of us on an individual level, that helps each other person to create themselves individual, that we can collectively then come together and enjoy, but still love each other as individuals, and allow each other to make mistakes, allow each other to have freedom, allow each other to do many, many things that some of us would never do. But the process of this is so that each can uniquely find God, uniquely create some part of God, uniquely be a part of their Creator, and without the encumbrance of some part of humanity refusing to allow that because they want to get rid of God or be God themselves. But God, that God that they want to be is a bastard of God. It's not the real God. It's the God that they think comes through power and control. God gave up power and control. Said, I don't want nothing to do with it. Power and control will be up to the energy kingdom and life in general, but mostly human life. Wow. So we're in the three lower worlds where form and energy become dominant. That's where power and control becomes dominant. And we're here to understand it, to use it in ways that doesn't destroy the choices of others and the freedom of others, doesn't destroy the love and wide giving of others, and helps us to do more of that as souls, living souls here, but our souls can't come here and do that. Well, why not? You've heard me explain this. The soul comes here, it has to take on the same bodies and senses we're using. It becomes us. It's no different. The soul needs to stay where it is because it still is growing in its own space, which is the higher mental world, where we don't exist except we borrow some vibrations, you can call it, from there. Yes, dimensional reality actually is based upon vibration, not particles, but the whole of it. So, So basically, we borrow some of these vibrations from the higher mental world. We call them concepts, and we use them, but we don't live in them. Well, most people don't. If you're really advanced as a human being, you start living concepts. You live that. But that's a hard thing, and most people don't do that. So here is our dilemma. We're right here, right now, and this is where the battle is, because we've got these senses that we have to use the form in. Remember, we have to become part of the form. We join with the energy that we have to find some way of working it out, so that energy gives us good senses without us taking that information and screwing it up because our personalities are doing whatever they're doing for personal gain and selfishness and power and control and nastiness to other people. We are in that crucible. And the crucible at the present time is no longer, a circumstance of discomfort or even hurting others. It's now reaching the point of survival. Now, I don't want it to sound like doom and gloom, but be aware that the survival of the planet Earth will be decided in probably the next 2 centuries. Now, I know a lot of you say, well, but I thought the end of days are coming. You know, and what about last month? We were supposed to all go. I told you, don't follow that. Last year and right now, things have gotten very bad, and there's been some very bad alternatives, and things have happened. But those things are the seeds for other problems that will continue to grow. How do we get out of it? By finding God's plan in each of our individual lives. Can I tell you what that is for you? No. Can I give you more freedom to explore it and be creative yourself? Yes. One way is to educate. Hello, I'm here. The other ways are the following. To politically organize and try to prevent intervention from those who are seeking power and control through government and politics. Another way is to use technology and energy in general in ways that helps people to not use as much energy themselves, but at the same time, not have forces, as many forces against them. That's called the third way. That also includes the ability to have enough money and time to be able to do things that will be part of God's plan to create. The other thing, the fourth way, is to create an artistic expression. And the artistic expression can be in any way, as long as it brings people's senses to a higher level of expression, a higher level of awareness. That level that you're aiming for, if you're using this fourth way, is called beauty. When someone experiences beauty, their senses take in more energy efficiently without creating as many forces. Ugliness creates huge forces and reduces the senses. So to improve the senses, beauty is part of art, at least art that is virtuous. Art that is not virtuous does the opposite. Now, virtue in art, if defined the way I described it, is not a subjective element. Any art that increases people's senses and improves it, improves them, has a virtue to it. Art that destroys people's senses or does nothing for them, at best, is a non-virtuous or possibly a dark means. You be the judge. Each person determines for themselves what forms of art and what expressions of art helps their senses grow. All right. Remember, awareness tells you how much sense you have. And then knowledge grows from that, and you get consciousness eventually if you choose. So let's go on. The fifth way of dealing with this system that you could find is a development of truth through both logic and conceptual, higher conceptual reasoning that allows a person to find both wisdom and truth in their thinking mentally. Now, what is wisdom? Wisdom is the wholeness of the concept and its examples, or we call them thought forms sometimes. Concepts and examples have to be whole and uncontradictory. They can't contradict. You can't have an example of something, of a concept, that doesn't support the concept. If that's the case, then you don't have a wise thought process. But wisdom also has another element to it. Wisdom always employs the idea that whatever thought you're doing, your motive for doing it is not to gain something for yourself in a lower self sense, but to gain it for all selves. So whatever you create mentally, you want to share with others. You want to help others to gain something themselves in the same process. Whoa. And in a way, it makes everybody kind of a teacher. Not necessarily formally, but it makes people, as people gaining consciousness and become wise, they always become in some realm a teacher. They may not consider themselves that, may not even call themselves that, but that's what they do, they end up doing to some extent. And then the sixth way to get to the plan, to find the plan within yourself and do something about it, that sixth way is through the feeling of being God, which some people call faith. And this faith is not that God exists. This is about God's plan now. The faith is in that the plan works. In other words, what you need to have faith in is that God is good, not that God exists. If you don't have faith in God is good, you don't have faith. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, there's too many times people come to the conclusion that God is no good because there's so many bad things in him. But the bad things that happen are, for the most part, the result of humans not following God's plan. So you get this reductional absurd issue when you try to bring it down to, well, look at all the bad things, and God's at fault. God can't be at fault because God gave us the freedom to do as we choose. Okay. So you got to believe that God is good. Faith in God is good resolves all faith. No matter how much you believe in God, if you don't believe God is good, if you believe God is a God of vengeance, the Old Testament, Moses, God is a God of vengeance. That may not lead you to the conclusion God is good, and that's a problem. So the Bible may not help you, at least the Old Testament. Okay, so, and then the last thing you need is that you need to recognize that we live in a material world, and the synthesis of all form, and the exchange of synthesis of form between and among all people is the foundation of civilization, because it allows people to exchange time and energy in efficient ways and to be creative in the process of doing so. We call that business, marketing, or interaction in a market world, or however you want to describe free market. And that is the process in which it is so critical to immerse ourselves and to provide adequate means for people to behave if they want to. Not everybody's going to do that, but you can. Those are the ways you can find God. And we're out of time. But I do want you to think about this, because God's plan for development of consciousness in life is an amazing source for all of us to become the greater of who we really can be. Until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.